Chapter 6, Dealing with Differences. When I was 14 years old, my first love was Tony. Our love was intense, exciting, and passionate. And yet we couldn't have been more different. Tony was gregarious while I was more reserved. He was obnoxious and unfiltered, whereas I was cool and circumspect. He was slapstick, I was witty. His big personality made him audible within a 2-block radius and mostly intolerable to those around him, whereas I was generally liked and trusted by my friends' parents. Tony was a social bull in a china shop while I strived to be a gazelle. From an outsider's view, we didn't make any sense. But I figured, hey, if Paula Abdul and the cartoon cat from the video Opposites Attract could make it work, then why couldn't Tony and I? Our love was palpable. And in my partial defense, Tony would reveal a tender, sweet side of himself to me that was rarely seen by others. I also admired how uninhibited he was. And he had a fierce, protective hunger for me, which was exactly what I needed as a neglected teenage girl with no father in sight. Even though Tony's and my differences created a fiery polarity, they also drove us nuts, provoking late-night screaming matches in my bedroom, where he would destroy my art projects, and in retaliation, I would throw the gifts he had made me in his woodshop class from my third-story apartment window. Our differences, which drew us together like two opposing magnets, eventually became combustive and destructive because some fundamental aspects of compatibility were missing for us. Tony was my first lesson in how love is not all you need, and how love and chemistry alone are definitely not enough to maintain a relationship or keep your artwork from being destroyed. Years later, when I would run into Tony or hear about him from mutual friends, it was crystal clear that while he will always hold a special place in my heart as my first love, our lives were undoubtedly destined to go in very different directions because of how different and incompatible we were. As an adult, I have had several, albeit less dramatic, iterations of this early lesson about how the power of attraction and love can keep us drawn to and bonded to someone without guaranteeing a healthy relationship. When we are under the influence of the mind-altering haze of NRE, we tend to minimize differences between ourselves and our partners and focus mostly on the similarities. The rose-colored glasses of the hormonal honeymoon phase distort our perception, and we often mistake red flags for red roses. As the hormones begin to subside, our dissimilarities can become increasingly more apparent. Also, once we begin to differentiate as a couple, whether that differentiation coincides with the waning of new relationship energy or happens later down the road, the difference between us as partners can start to have more of an impact on our connection. Many of the differences we have with our partners can be complementary, positive, and even necessary. These kinds of differences can keep us stimulated, inspire novelty, and encourage us to grow beyond our individual perspectives and comfort levels. Differences can create chemistry. But there are also other differences between partners that make a relationship untenable, or can leave you feeling like there is just too much incompatibility for things to really work out. The issue of compatibility in relationship can be tricky and confusing. Some experts swear by the necessity of compatibility factors, which would be the things that individuals have in common, such as your favorite books, music, and shows, your personality profile, or your political views and religious beliefs. Dating apps have algorithms to rate your percentage of compatibility based on how similar or dissimilar your answers are to questions that gauge your personality and interests so that you can best match with your next mate. Professional matchmakers and dating coaches will even advise you to ask your date questions regarding their hobbies or favorite musical artists, not just as good icebreakers, but also as ways to determine whether you should even consider a second date. Other relationship experts suggest that these kinds of objective compatibility factors have little impact on relationship health and sustainability, and instead assert that it is the presence of more subjective values and process-based compatibility factors that actually determine its viability. Examples of these subjective factors include things like the partner's level of commitment and effort to make the relationship work. Similarly, others in this camp focus on how partners treat each other, whether or not they can create shared meaning together, their capacity to support each other as individuals, how they handle conflict, whether or not they actually enjoy spending time with one another, and the presence or absence of respect in the relationship. At this point in my career, I can safely say that I've seen enough partnerships to build a case in either direction in terms of whether the objective measures of compatibility do or don't matter. For some people, objective personality measures such as shared extroversion or introversion bear no weight in the relationship, whereas for others, they absolutely do. If one person's life or career is devoted to a certain interest, having a partner that doesn't share that interest with them can eventually become a deal breaker. Because without that shared interest, they will either have little to connect on or too much time apart. And most relationships struggle without the more subjective and process-based compatibility factors, such as mutual respect, admiration, willingness to repair after conflict, and clarity about the commitment level. In the same way that we talked about how C&M transitions can expose the cracks in the foundation of your relationship, so too can they create a heightened awareness of the differences between you and your partner. The paradigm shift has a way of shaking up your differences and turning your compatibility inside out. In relationships that were initially monogamous, sometimes these differences already existed before opening, but they were either less noticeable or were more tolerable in the context of monogamy. But now in non-monogamy, they have become more substantial and intolerable. Similarly, in relationships that are already C&M, certain changes such as the levels of priority or the addition of new partners can unmask certain differences between partners that can become overwhelming. Ways that people felt themselves to be highly complementary, like peanut butter and jelly, now become more like oil and water. In other situations, the C&M transition itself creates brand new incompatibilities that now challenge the feasibility of the relationship altogether. When virtue becomes vice. As discussed in the previous chapter on differentiation, both the monogamous romantic ideals of our culture and the relationship stage of symbiosis encourage downplaying differences between partners and promote the fusion of selves within relationships. While in most cases, I don't think people are completely unaware of the bigger, more challenging differences between themselves and their partners, I do think this romantic ideal of monogamy, along with the safety and security that higher degrees of hierarchy can provide, have a way of getting people to ignore, minimize, or even justify the things about their partners that feel fundamentally incompatible. Understandably, people don't want to address the differences that could rock or capsize, for that matter, the boat of the relationship. Naming and acknowledging the differences between us and our partners is always risky, regardless of the type of relationship we're in. Differences threaten our security in the relationship. Will my partner still love me if they find out I see things differently? However, to keep a relationship healthy and growing, we need to be courageous enough to rock the boat, bring up difficult conversations when necessary, and try to figure out how to bridge some of our differences, accept them, or talk about options for moving forward in new directions. The transition to non-monogamy or to less hierarchical or couple-centric forms of C&M can have some interesting consequences for the way partners experience their pre-existing differences. For example, in one couple, Donna was originally drawn to her wife, Alexis, because of her spontaneity, sense of adventure, and zest for life. Alexis's qualities brought Donna alive in ways she'd never experienced before, initiating spontaneous day trips for them, exposing Donna to new foods she never would have tried on her own, and even planning epic surprise birthday parties for her. Even though Donna did have some complaints about Alexis's impulsive spending habits and more mercurial temperament, they were overshadowed by the benefits Donna experienced as a result of her wife's exuberance. Alexis, on the other hand, expressed being drawn to Donna precisely because of her more practical, grounded disposition. Donna was present, reliable, and sensible, functioning as a stable rock in Alexis's more capricious life. Fast forward to the opening of their relationship. The very same attributes that were once complementary and experienced as life-enhancing in a monogamous context now became chasms that felt unbridgeable in the new polyamorous one. Donna, who had previously drawn a lot of meaning and purpose from being her wife's rock and anchor, now felt neglected and even used as Alexis channeled her vibrant and creative spontaneity into other relationships. Donna was overwhelmed by how fast Alexis was falling in love or having sex with new partners, and she began to feel like all the ups and downs of Alexis's other relationships were giving her emotional whiplash. Alexis's more carefree side led her on more than one occasion to break their relationship agreements, which began to erode Donna's trust. Additionally, Donna no longer wanted to just be the safe haven for Alexis, which in the polyamorous context meant that Donna was often playing the role of therapist or crisis manager for Alexis's other relationships. Donna also wanted the chance to be an interesting and exciting play partner, receiving the same level of high-intensity attention that Alexis was doling out to others. On the other hand, Alexis felt that her once dependable rock of a wife had become an immovable weight, preventing her from any forward momentum with others. Alexis now experienced Donna as controlling, difficult, and inflexible, with no respect or consideration for her own unique pacing. Donna's more grounded nature had turned into stagnation and resistance. And the more she tried to slow Alexis down, the more Alexis responded by asserting her freedom. In the case of Donna and Alexis, the differences they once appreciated about each other, which enhanced their sense of harmony in their monogamous relationship, quickly turned into disharmony when they opened up. In the transition to polyamory, Alexis's spontaneity and willingness to try new things was interpreted as recklessness that overwhelmed Donna and undermined her trust. And Donna's stability and steadfastness, which had previously provided safety and security for Alexis, was now a source of intolerable restriction, impeding her ability to explore new relationships on her own terms. This is a prime example of how sometimes the differences that are initially attractive and connective for partners in the context of monogamy can quickly become objectionable and antagonistic in non-monogamy. Likewise, what feels harmonious in more hierarchical forms of CNM can later turn into a CNM cacophony if primacy is dismantled. This kind of radical 180-degree shift in our experience of the qualities that we once found appealing in our partners can be extremely jarring and call into question whether there is enough compatibility to continue the relationship. When the previously manageable becomes intolerable. Another variation of this dynamic is the situation where pre-existing differences between partners go from manageable to unmanageable, as they transition from one paradigm to the other or change the style of CNM they are practicing. Cases like these are different from the previous example because here, the original difference was already experienced as problematic, albeit more tolerable, before their CNM transition, instead of originally being seen as something positive. An example of this dynamic is in the case of Monica and Frank. When they started dating, they were both CNM, each of them having mostly casual relationships with others. Monica made it clear that two of her most important relational values were honesty and transparency. Any omission or alteration of the truth could be interpreted as a betrayal and cause a lack of safety and trust. Frank had a different relationship to honesty, which meant there were times when placating or telling quote-unquote white lies was acceptable and appropriate, believing there were certain situations when it was actually better to tell people what they needed to hear in order to save face or avoid unnecessary conflict. Occasionally, Monica would hear Frank dip into this gray area in conversations with friends, his kids, or clients, saying things that felt dishonest to her. She didn't like it, but when she would question him on it, he would always reassure her that he wasn't hurting anyone with his behavior and that he was always completely honest with her. Even though Frank's micro-dishonesties with others made her feel uncomfortable, Monica tolerated it. And she reassured herself that he wouldn't do this with her, especially since she was his main squeeze. Later, when Monica wanted to become more serious with another partner and change her style of CNM to being more solo polyamorous with two non-nesting primary partners, being Frank and this other partner she had, Frank's flexibility with the truth eventually became a deal breaker for Monica. To compensate for the changes Monica initiated, Frank increased his tendency when dating other women to downplay the significance of his very close and involved partnership with Monica, so these women wouldn't get cold feet or be spooked out by his level of commitment. On the other hand, with Monica, he would reveal information about his dates with other women in ways that didn't always add up for her. He would omit certain details to avoid making Monica upset or trigger her jealousy. And this over time started to create suspicion and mistrust. In their new version of less hierarchical CNM, safety and trust became even more important to Monica, as she was now required to actively grapple with higher degrees of insecurity and jealousy with Frank and his other partners. Her vigilance of the relational landscape with Frank was intensified, and she was more sensitive than ever to anything that seemed off in their communication. In their previous CNM structure, where they were functioning more as each other's primary partners and there wasn't the same need to be as alert, she was able to tolerate the difference between their respective relationship to honesty. But as Frank connected with more partners, putting Monica's secure attachment to the test, she could no longer hold the same space for his behavior. As she continued to uncover discrepancies in his accounts of situations with other partners, she realized she needed to exit the relationship. In non-monogamy, where the relational complexity is greatly increased and the stakes can feel much higher, the importance of being transparent, maintaining open communication, keeping our word, sticking to our agreements, and staying in integrity cannot be overstated. Because non-monogamy can already be inherently more challenging for many of us, our threshold for shenanigans and questionable behavior can be much lower. Successfully managing multiple romantic relationships requires more emotional and mental energy than we're used to putting out. And when we are working with reduced emotional bandwidth, the ways we weren't in alignment with our partners can now seem exponentially more taxing. And what was previously manageable about our partner can become intolerable. You're talking on Mars, I'm talking on Venus, and we are lost in translation. Another big difference between partners that can become problematic occurs in language and communication. Obviously, misunderstandings and miscommunication happen in all human relationships. But in CNM, it seems as though the potential for misinterpreting our partner's words increases exponentially. As we negotiate the terms of new relationships and make agreements about what's permitted and what's off limits, suddenly it's as if partners are speaking two different languages, even though they're actually using the very same words. Running the gamut from amusing to baffling to outright enraging, these vastly different interpretations of what we tell our partners can have significant consequences for the relationship. After Dave and I separated romantically, I went through a period of solo polyamory, which I loved. However, when I met my partner, Will, I had just gone through two significant breakups a few months earlier, and my heart and nervous system needed the time to create a secure foundation with just one person. Will and I decided to have an initial period of exclusivity together, but I was clear that with him, my polyamory was inevitable. We became nesting partners, and since we both had a high level of communication and skill, I was extremely surprised that when we opened up, we began to have repeat communication breakdowns right out of the box. In one situation in particular, Will was going out of town with my son for the weekend. I was excited to host a date at my house with my new partner, but I wanted to make sure Will and I were clear about the details of what that would look like. Before Will left for his trip, I distinctly remember saying to him, "Since you'll have the car, I'm going to have Ethan, my new partner, come here for our date, but he's not going to stay the night." Ethan and I had yet to have a sleepover, and I wanted to reassure Will that even though Ethan was coming over to the house, I wasn't escalating to an overnight, especially without talking about it first. The following day, after my date with Ethan, Will and I spoke on the phone, and he asked, "How was the date?" When I replied that it was good and that it was really nice to have Ethan over at the house, Will was surprised and hurt. It turns out we both had a very different idea of what the concept of, quote, "have Ethan come here," unquote, meant. For him, Ethan lives over an hour away from us, so Will assumed that "here" just meant here in the city of Asheville, where we live, and that Ethan and I could go out on the town for the evening. However, when I said, quote, "I'm going to have Ethan come here," unquote, I literally meant here at our house, precisely where I was standing with Will as we were having that conversation. It turns out that Will also did not hear me say that Ethan would not be sleeping over, which obviously fed into the misunderstanding. Regardless of the fact that Ethan did not sleep over, Will was emotionally unprepared for the fact that Ethan came to our house and that he and I had sex in my bedroom. Even though I thought I couldn't have been more clear in what I said, and I was being a good polyamorous partner, doing my best to prepare and inform him, Will felt completely blindsided on the phone as we talked about how my date went. Later, it dawned on me that a few weeks before this situation, my son had two of his friends over for a playdate, and at some point, I told Will that the boys were spending the night. A few hours later, when it was getting close to bedtime, Will asked when the boys' parents were coming to pick them up. I reminded him that the boys were having a sleepover, and he vaguely remembered me mentioning it earlier. It was a similar situation to my previous example. But obviously, the implications of not hearing me mention the sleepover part were vastly different. My son having friends sleepover is a situation with low stakes, emotionally, and no real consequences for our relationship. but not catching that Ethan was not intending to sleep over, which would have put, "I'm going to have Ethan come here," into a greater context, had much higher stakes and consequences. For us, it would have meant an escalation in my relationship with Ethan that excluded Will and Will's need to have some emotional prep time before I had sex with someone else in our house. Often the meanings of particular words that seem absolutely clear or obvious to both people later turn out to have been interpreted in very different ways. The meaning of words or phrases that play a central role in agreements between partners can get lost in translation, and this can have serious repercussions. Things like having protected sex, I won't be out too late, or we're just going to go hang out, may seem to carry little ambiguity on the surface, but can in fact be construed drastically differently by each person. One of my favorite anecdotes regarding the CNM phenomenon is a situation in which, in my practice, I've had not one, not two, but three different couples complain about their differing interpretations of the phrase, quote, go have fun. For simplicity, I'll share the story from just one couple's perspective. In this relationship, one partner, Jake, was polyamorous and the other, Rick, was monogamous. Jake told Rick that a mutual friend of theirs had just expressed interest in him. Rick was excited by this news because he trusted this particular friend, and it felt like an emotionally safer situation for him than some of the previous people Jake had been with, whom Rick hadn't known as well. As Jake was leaving for his date, Rick cheerfully sent him off with an enthusiastic, "Go have fun, baby!" After Jake got home from the date and shared that he had had sex with this trusted friend, Rick was shocked. In response to Rick's dismay, Jake said, "But you told me to go have fun." To which Rick replied, "Yeah, but fun means go have a good conversation over some coffee or tea, not sex the first time you meet up." Perplexed, Jake finally retorted, "When you said, go have fun, I thought you were giving me your blessing to do whatever I wanted. Coffee and conversation are nice, but not fun. For me, sex is fun." Typically, this kind of miscommunication is not intentional or even conscious, since we naturally hear what we want to hear or distort what we hear to fit our personal hopes and expectations. The desire to have a particular experience can become a powerful filter through which we process our agreements with partners. And when we think we're getting what we wanted, we're probably not going to stop and look the gift horse in the mouth. However, one of the big lessons of these unfortunate breakdowns in communication is that we need to do exactly that. Slow down and make sure everyone has the same understanding of the agreement we just made and intentions we just stated. Success is in the details, and it can save everyone involved a lot of heartache and hard feelings to verify that you are truly on the same page before going out on a date with someone else. When it comes to agreements, specificity is worth its weight in gold, along with writing down agreements, clarifying what vague terms like fun, safe, play, sex, kink, or later mean, and holding an attitude of open curiosity and collaboration. Name your differences. Getting familiar with and naming the differences that show up in our intimate relationships is an important way to proactively engage them and ideally diffuse the tension or disconnection they might be causing. First, it can be helpful to think about differences in terms of categories. For example, there can be differences in personality, such as between introverts and extroverts, or between people who are verbal processors, needing to talk through everything, and people who primarily integrate information quietly in their heads. Situational differences may arise when partners have significantly different incomes or one partner struggles with a chronic illness while another person is healthy. Partners can have widely different attitudes and relationships to money and spending, which can create challenges. Key differences in pacing may also come up in terms of how fast or slow partners move in their new relationships and form new attachments. Additionally, partners can have very different risk tolerances around things like sexually transmitted infections or other infectious disease risks, or about being with someone who is or isn't vaccinated. Think about some of these differences between you and a partner and how being in the context of monogamy or non-monogamy, or with higher or lesser degrees of hierarchy or priority, made some of them easier or more challenging. Another lesser known difference between partners that I see show up as more challenging in CNM is what I like to call the difference of sequencing. As individuals, we all tend to have our own unique sequence of how we perform the three basic human behaviors of think, feel, and act. While obviously we all do these fundamental things countless times throughout the course of any given day, the sequence in which we do and prioritize them can differ significantly depending on who we are. For instance, if you are a feel, act, think type, you will typically respond to situations by first having a strong emotion or feeling, which then propels you into action. After which, once everything is all said and done, you will reflect on the impact of your actions. However, if you are a think, act, feel type, you will first ponder the implications of your potential decisions and then act accordingly without a clear sense of how you actually feel about your decision until after the fact. People have their own tendencies to work through these three stages in specific sequences, with our first attribute typically dominating our decision-making process. Obviously, each particular sequence can have its own advantages and disadvantages. But the interesting consideration for us is the way these differences in our sequencing can affect our partnerships. For example, if you are someone who thinks first and you are paired with an act first type, their tendency to jump into action before weighing all the consequences could eventually drive you up the wall. This could be especially true in a scenario where, after newly opening your relationship, your act first partner flies into action with someone new, too excited to stop and think about the agreements you'd made together and the potential emotional impact on you. The presence of these differences can bring some partners to ask themselves whether they should stay or leave the relationship. In the examples we have just named, the recognition of these differences can even make us question if we even like or respect our partner anymore. Shining a light on our incompatibilities can bring up a lot of uncertainty about whether we actually still want to be with the other person. I often pose the question to partners, would you still choose your partner if you were just meeting them for the first time? And it's fascinating to hear their answers. As we come to terms with the recognition of our core differences, our perspectives and our felt sense of the relationship can change dramatically. Sitting down with your partners and doing an inventory of your respective similarities and differences can be a very helpful exercise for bringing potentially challenging dynamics, as well as points of appreciation and celebration to the surface of your awareness. As you see and name these similarities and differences in a supportive space, hopefully you can all learn to recognize them as unique attributes that, despite their sometimes grating nature, make you who you are instead of simply being the bane of your partner's existence. Here are some questions to consider in these conversations. What are the ways that you and your partners are similar? How are your similarities supportive? How are they challenging? What are the main differences you can identify between you and your partners? Which of those differences typically create challenges between you? Which ones are more complementary and supportive? Can you identify the origins of those differences? Did they used to be sources of attraction or appreciation, but now seem to only cause friction? Were they things that you definitely noticed previously, but that were only mildly bothersome or problematic before opening your relationship or going through a CNM transition? Do some of these differences feel bridgeable? And if not, would changing the structure of the relationship make some of these differences manageable? New paradigm, new differences. The differences that can shake up a relationship aren't always pre-existing issues or personality traits that later become intolerable. Sometimes it's the transition from monogamy to non-monogamy itself that generates new, unanticipated differences between partners. As you explore the world of CNM, you may be exposed to a much wider range of relationship ideas and concepts, many of which you will have never encountered, considered, or given yourself permission to explore. While it's certainly possible to be monogamous and interested in things like BDSM, non-binary consciousness, erotic blueprints, healing attachment wounds, interpersonal conflict resolution skills, conscious communication, relationship check-ins, and so on, these things are typically more prevalent and promoted within the context of different CNM communities, forums, and media. Exposure to the concepts and ideas embedded in these areas of interest can awaken completely new passions, desires, questions, and trajectories of personal exploration that radically change the way you fundamentally see yourself and your relationships. These changes can mean big shifts in terms of your personal standards, expectations, and values. And these shifts can in turn have consequences for your pre-existing relationships. As it stands, our mainstream culture is not particularly interested in or focused on raising our relational consciousness very much. And so you can easily enter a monogamous relationship without really having much relationship savvy or competency. Apart from seeking help with the occasional conflict or crisis, it will typically not occur to many monogamous couples to actively engage in continuing education for their relationship. One of my close friends actually joked that her recent attempts to go back to exclusive relationships after being CNM for years was unsuccessful because she was having trouble finding any monogamous partners with enough communication skills that it made it worth her time. And as cliche as it may sound, I can't tell you how many, typically women, in heterosexual marriages I've seen roll their eyes at the thought of their husband even considering therapy or even reading a relationship book together. I have found that people who already experience some kind of marginalization or identity as not fitting neatly into the parameters of conventional society are much more likely to gravitate to spaces where challenging and deconstructing social norms is commonplace. In general, this is typically true within different CNM communities. These arise from dynamic intersections of various subcultures that attract unique individuals who, aside from non-monogamy, are often also interested in things like, among other things, sex positivity, different sexual orientations, gender fluidity, understanding neurodiversity, therapeutic use of psychedelics, tantra, and issues concerning race, class, and privilege. This means that if people who are curious about CNM start to engage with non-monogamous communities at large, they are inevitably introduced to much more than just the ins and outs of consensual non-monogamy. they are also initiated into a whole universe of new ideas and experiences that can have a profound impact on their basic sense of who they are. As partners get a taste of the new and expansive possibilities that are available to them through this exposure, they can change in totally unpredictable ways that can disrupt the status quo of their relationships. In the next chapter, I go into more depth about the personal awakening that can happen as a result of exposure to the multiverse of CNM and the various ways that awakening can unfold. But for now, I want to focus on a few of the differences that can arise between partners as they dive into and embrace the paradigm of non-monogamy, as well as how these particular differences can present unique relationship challenges. New partners, new differences. In the same way that the paradigm of CNM can create entirely new ways of being and self-expression for people, so too can new CNM partners have a paradigm-altering effect on your worldview, personality, and identity. To be clear, I'm not just referring to the phenomenon of NRE and its power to make you act in unpredictable ways, but instead to the way that being in a relationship with particular people can tangibly change you into someone new. Some of these changes can be a boon for all of your relationships, just as a rising tide lifts all boats. The growth and evolution that you experience directly from your new relationship can have a positive impact on all of your relationships. As one partner inspires you to be a better version of yourself, this new and improved self has the potential to positively influence every aspect of your life. As one of my own partners once said to me, quote, "You're inspiring me to be a better person, which is making me be a better husband to my wife and father to my kids." On the flip side, sometimes the person who emerges in response to new partners is a product of changes that you would probably have preferred never happened. As your partner enthusiastically soaks up all the novel experiences and ideas that come their way via their newest partner, you cringe in dismay as you start to question who the hell they are becoming. It's possible to watch your partner, under the influence of their latest romance, take on new religious beliefs, political views, substance use habits, sexual preferences, attitudes, or opinions that begin to alienate you and create a gulf in your relationship. Or maybe it's a question of safety, where your partner starts to engage in risky, unhealthy, or destructive behavior, and you have genuine concerns about their or your own well-being in relation to this new person. In other instances, it could be the case that your partner stays exactly the same with you, but they turn into an amazing person with someone else. Similar to the phenomenon of justice jealousy that I discussed in chapter 3, this is the infuriating situation in which one of your partners becomes the kind of person you've always wanted to experience in the context of a completely different relationship. As one client of mine described, after successfully navigating an open marriage of 18 years with her husband, everything changed when he met a new woman with whom he started to present as a completely different human being. As my client indignantly watched from the sidelines, she had to digest the fact that whenever the new partner was around, her partner was markedly much happier and much more attentive, caring, fun, and enthusiastic about everything. However, in the new woman's absence, the husband would revert back to his old hum-ho demeanor, completely losing all the spark that he had displayed in her presence. The painful question that my client was left pondering was, why is he able to turn this kind of energy on for her and not for me? It's a fair question, and one that is echoed by many people in the same situation. In cases such as this, the partner who is changing in new ways is often not totally aware of their behavior, or at least of the impact of their behavior on existing partners. It's easy to get caught up in the invigorating energy of a relationship that still hasn't accumulated all the weight of shared history and lose sight of the way we are affecting our other relationships. Having to watch a partner morph into someone different under the influence of a new relationship can create strong feelings of resentment, frustration, and confusion, and even provoke the sensation that we are no longer desirable or important to them. If left unaddressed, this can start to create toxic patterns in the relationship that are hard to overcome. However, if partners are willing to recognize and acknowledge the ways their newfound personality traits, mannerisms, hobbies, attitudes, or behaviors are negatively impacting their original relationships, and can find genuine ways to reattune to the needs of their initial partners, they can restore balance to the connections. Chapter 6, continued. Finally, new partners can also create new differences by creating game-changing relationships. These are the people we meet who create an unprecedented shift in how we view the world, ourselves, and especially our relationships. They don't just change how we ourselves show up in the world, they also change what we want and expect from our other partnerships. A game-changing relationship is a unique situation that may open our eyes to previously unimagined depth, intimacy, and connection on an intellectual, emotional, sexual, and even spiritual level. We may experience being listened to, empathized with, and supported in ways we may never have before, and the relationship may end up raising our relational bar so high that everything else falls short in comparison. It's both amazing and horrible. A transcendental romance and a tragedy all at the same time, depending on which side of the game-changing experience you end up on. In the world of CNM, the topic of game-changing relationships can be taboo. I believe this is one of the big reasons that CNM is often feared in general. In monogamy, the assumption, not necessarily the reality, is that once we've found our person, we stop looking elsewhere. The same rationale is even applied to people who are non-monogamous, suggesting they will give up CNM once they have finally found their one quote-unquote right person. If our partners are no longer dating others, we think we can relax because it's hard to find what you're no longer looking for. Of course, game-changing relationships can show up regardless of whether you are monogamous, celibate, or non-monogamous. But undoubtedly, people who are CNM seem more likely to stumble upon a game-changing relationship if they are actively dating or open to meeting new partners. While the non-monogamous paradigm is not about continuing to date until you find the one or endlessly searching for better partners, I do think the higher potential for game-changing relationships is often a contributor to the underlying anxiety that many CNM people grapple with consistently. While in principle, monogamy can attempt to shield us from this uncomfortable possibility, in CNM, there is no pretending that such a risk does not exist. Instead, here are some questions and suggestions to consider. Is your current CNM relationship style being influenced by fear of you or one of your partners experiencing a game-changing relationship? If so, how has this fear been impacting you, your partners, and your style of CNM? Work on accepting that this is part of the risk that comes with any relationship, and it is not something you can control or prevent, especially when it comes to your partners. Accepting this allows you to better relate to your fear and choose how to engage with the risk of game-changing relationships. If you are experiencing a game-changing relationship, be honest about it. Get clear within yourself what this means for you and how it impacts your pre-existing relationships. Have direct and kind conversations with your partners about the changes you are experiencing through this new relationship and how the changes within you are initiating changes within your relationships. Be honest about the level of relationship that you want with your partners now and what you are realistically able to offer. Take responsibility for your actions and acknowledge the impact this has on your partners. Do not compare your partners to each other or blame your pre-existing partners for the game-changing relationship you're having. If one of your partners is experiencing a game-changing relationship and is changing in ways you find undesirable or is less available to you, ask yourself if these changes are compatible with who you are and what you want in relationships. If you are feeling mistreated by your partner as they engage in this relationship, are they able to acknowledge, address, and repair the hurt with you? Are you still receiving the level of time and attention that you need or want from them? Sometimes the changes that come as a result of your partner's new relationship can leave you needing to accept and grieve the loss of certain aspects of the relationship. In other cases, you may find that you need to make specific requests to your partner in order to feel like the relationship is still viable. The important thing is not to fall into the trap of blaming yourself for your partner's behaviors or for the fact that they have had a game-changing relationship. Remember that their experience is not indicative of a deficiency in you. Non-monogamy as lifestyle versus non-monogamy as relationship orientation. As people practice and explore non-monogamy, the ways they make sense of their CNM preferences and behaviors and the meaning they give to their CNM identity can vary. There is much debate as to whether being non-monogamous is an orientation or a lifestyle choice. And because of this, I intentionally focused dozens of my interviews on this very topic, asking people about whether they experienced their monogamy or non-monogamy as a lifestyle choice versus an orientation, and then digging more thoroughly into what that really means for each of them. Several years ago, I also began to include this question in my initial intake with clients, offering me even more insight into hundreds of people's experiences as they would describe to me how they have come to define and understand themselves regarding being either monogamous or non-monogamous. What I found is that being monogamous or non-monogamous is not a rigid binary or typology, but a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, we have monogamy, where people are more monoamorous and monosexual. And on the other end, we have non-monogamy, where people are more polyamorous or polysexual. I do not think that any of the locations on the spectrum are necessarily permanent or static. But what I have encountered is that the people who are on either end of the further ends of the spectrum describe their version of monogamy or non-monogamy as an orientation. For them, being either monogamous or non-monogamous does not feel like a choice they are able to make. They experience it as how they are wired to be regarding romance and sex. In the middle of the spectrum, we find a whole range of individuals who, for a variety of reasons, are drawn to being either more monogamous or non-monogamous, but do not identify with it in the same way as the bi-orientation folks. While they also resonate more with the principles and philosophy of either the monogamous or non-monogamous paradigms, they see their placement on the spectrum more as a choice they are making, which, depending on the life circumstances in which they find themselves, could change at some point in the future. As couples open up, there can be disparity in how each person identifies their non-monogamy. Some people identify being non-monogamous as a lifestyle choice because for them, like any lifestyle, it can change, ebb and flow, and come and go. Unlike the orientation folks who feel CNM is a fundamental expression of who they are. As people open up or date each other within the CNM context, these differences can create obstacles, in particular when you have a lifestyle partner paired with a more of an orientation partner. This pairing can be particularly challenging to deal with because each person can have some significantly different needs and desires in regards to how their process of CNM unfolds. What I learned is that people who identify more with non-monogamy as a lifestyle choice can vary greatly in terms of their interest and enthusiasm. For many, it was an empowering choice they made as part of exploring themselves and learning more about their romantic and sexual preferences. In such cases, their relationship to non-monogamy was usually dictated more by where they were in life, such as a post-divorce experimental phase, or being in their 20s and 30s and dating, or in the 2010s when exclusivity was no longer assumed in the same way it had been for previous generations. Their relationship to non-monogamy was also dictated by what their needs were in the moment, or who their current partners were, than any deeply held conviction that they needed to be non-monogamous. Others who explore non-monogamy as a lifestyle choice would not have made the choice to embrace it if it hadn't been for the influence of someone else, typically a lover or spouse interested in exploring CNM. For them, the choice to enter non-monogamy didn't feel as empowering as it did for others, but they were willing to give it a try and eventually found that it genuinely worked for them. People who identified as non-monogamous as orientation described their relationship to being non-monogamous as just being who they essentially were and the fullest expression of their love or sexuality. As one person described, he was faithful in all of his monogamous relationships, but no matter how hard he tried, he always fell in love with other people, feeling like he had to deny important aspects of himself just to stay with one partner. As he described, quote, "I was able to play the monogamy game for a long time, but one day I realized it was killing me to deny myself like this. Literally, I was having unexplainable health issues, and my doctor eventually told me to go to therapy because there was no physical explanation for the pain I had. One day, a friend introduced me to a woman who is polyamorous. She told me about what her life was like, and I began to cry on the spot. I knew what she was describing was who I was supposed to be, and I couldn't pretend anymore. It was like a cork was pulled out of the bottom of me, and all of the physical pain drained away. All of the monogamous baggage left me, and I was finally free to be me." One of the main dilemmas that partners encounter when one identifies with being CNM as more of a lifestyle and the other as an orientation is that they have to confront how differently they both perceive the importance of non-monogamy in their lives. When the question of non-monogamy is framed as, "This is who I am," it essentially becomes non-negotiable. How can you deny me the chance to be myself? A complicating factor in this dynamic is also that many non-monogamy as orientation people feel like they have already waited years to start living out this aspect of their identity. They may or may not have had multiple relationships at the same time in the past, but they certainly intuited there was another way of doing relationships that was more in alignment with their felt sense of self. For them, finding the structure and practice of non-monogamy is a tremendously powerful validation of something they have wanted for potentially a long time. The experience of having already delayed living out their preferred relational identity helps explain why the pacing can often be so different for the members of these couples. For the non-monogamy as lifestyle individuals, the faster pace of their partner can be extremely difficult to handle. Since they don't have the same zeal for non-monogamy, the urgency of their partners can be confusing and a source of hurt. Another important consideration is that the lifestylers still have at least one foot in the monogamous paradigm or just a bit closer to it. The axis of their identity either still pivots around the narratives of monogamy or is potentially closer to monogamy than their partners, which often means they can be quicker to question the value of non-monogamy in their lives when things get hard. For them, monogamy might always be a viable option in their back pocket, or at the very least, seem like a reasonable request to make of their partner when they are struggling with the transition. Conflict can arise here because partners can have very different needs in terms of how CNM plays out in their relationships. As each partner in this pairing interprets the other's perspective through their own position on the spectrum, they can both feel unseen, misunderstood, and hopeless about how to make it work. Both individuals can feel torn between taking care of themselves and taking care of the relationship. For the non-monogamy as orientation partner, the dilemma is, I want the freedom to explore, but it hurts you when I do, and I don't want to hurt you. And for the non-monogamy as lifestyle partner, the conundrum is, I don't want to stop you from getting your needs met or being happy, but I can't emotionally handle your process. So how do we navigate these differences of relational realities? They can create a painful, even unbearable dynamic where we feel torn between meeting our own needs and being whole and complete as a person and meeting the needs of a relationship we value or a person we greatly love. The way we frame and approach this tension is critical for addressing this issue without escalating conflict. First, just becoming aware of this difference can be a big help for partners. If partners are dealing with some version of this combination of non-monogamy as orientation and as lifestyle, recognizing that their behavior has more to do with their position on the spectrum than an attempt to thwart needs or control their partner can hopefully help them see each other with more compassion and understanding. Another consideration that can be helpful for these kinds of pairings is how to best address the issue of pacing. Partners really need to decide together how to answer the question of how fast or slow to go with new relationships. As partners date other people, it's incredibly important that they maintain a sense of shared reality within their relationships. Dating new people can be destabilizing for current relationships and trigger a number of deep-seated insecurities for all partners. Attachment fears can get easily activated, and it's particularly important that we make decisions with a lot of awareness, care, and sensitivity during this delicate phase of going through a CNM transition. Moving too fast or too slow can give partners the sense that the process of the CNM transition we are in is no longer a shared process and that our relational realities are getting too far apart. Partners need to really stay open and be willing to hold space for the potentially big differences in each other's experiences. We need to undertake honest explorations of what really underlies the requests we make of our partners. If I make requests for you to not do certain things initially with new partners, such as overnights or oral sex, are my requests actually a question of pacing or an expression of a need to control your process? Sometimes a request to pump the brakes comes from a legitimate need to give our nervous systems a chance to recalibrate and integrate all the new changes. And sometimes the ask to slow down is a strategy to postpone exposure to the discomfort of seeing our partner with other people. On the other side of things, it's important to recognize when our desire to have new experiences with new partners is a healthy expression of our own differentiation, and when it starts to become a one-sided pursuit of our needs at the expense of the connection with our partners. It requires a great deal of self-awareness and trust between partners to authentically distinguish between these two possibilities and make genuine compromises on both sides. It's also important to be able to tell the difference between the feeling that you have to ask your partner for permission to have the experiences you want to have and having the consideration for your partner's feelings and needs, along with the willingness to temper your pace for the sake of the relationship. Granted, it can often be very difficult to strike a balance between these two perspectives, and not always easy to know when we should err on the side of advocating for our own needs or for the health of the original relationship. Differences in approach to C&M and relationship structure. There are many different ways to practice C&M, and as couples open their relationship or people in C&M relationships date new partners, it's very common that they either want or end up wanting very different C&M styles. This is yet another challenge that can emerge after the transition to non-monogamy has been initiated for people new to C&M. And it's a recurring experience for the seasoned C&M practitioner. What I observe is that people typically fall along two intersecting lines of possibilities in terms of their personal preferences for how to do non-monogamy. The first relates to the degree of togetherness or separateness with which they want to share their non-monogamous experiences with their partners. And the second relates to the degree of hierarchy or lack thereof that they want in their relationships. When partners are not in alignment about either of these two issues, the differences can be hard to overcome. Let's take a closer look at each of them. The degree of togetherness and separateness in C&M. For some people, the journey into C&M is something they genuinely want to share with a spouse or primary partner. For these individuals, their experiences have more meaning when done together and serve to strengthen the bond between them and their partner. Exploring C&M in tandem can also feel safer for some people because there are fewer opportunities for independent bonds to be formed. There are fewer unknowns and less uncertainty to grapple with, which can alleviate or at least reduce some of the anxiousness or insecurities that can arise. A gamut of possibilities are available to people who want a more shared C&M experience, and these can include swinging, threesomes, group sex, triads, or quad relationships, and even garden party or kitchen table polyamory. See the glossary in the PDF. The opposite of the shared experience is when partners want to keep their sexual and relational experiences more separate. The desire or need is to experience C&M on their own terms as an individual, apart from the context of their other relationships. This more independent approach, the extreme of which is commonly referred to as parallel polyamory, can be helpful for people coming out of an enmeshed or codependent dynamic where the need is to differentiate from their partner instead of further intertwining their realities. This preference can also have nothing to do with someone trying to circumvent getting too enmeshed or someone trying to assert their autonomy, but can also be based on connection styles, such as being more introverted and preferring to see people one-on-one, or just pure scheduling realities, such as that when you only see someone once a week or so, you want that time to just be with them, not in a group dynamic. Also, some people feel a desire to discover new parts of themselves through different relationships, and they feel that including their partners in their other relationships would only inhibit this discovery. As one person I interviewed said, quote, "I tried having all my partners hang out together, and they hated each other. Eventually, I realized I didn't need to have all my relationships overlap, and then I actually like to have partners that represent very different aspects of myself. Keeping my various connections separate allows me to embody those different selves in a way that wouldn't be possible if they crossed over." While it's certainly possible for partners to want a combination of these two approaches, for example, I currently have both a nesting kitchen table dynamic with Dave and my current nesting partner, as well as a parallel relationship outside of our poly family dynamic. The difficulties typically arise when individuals in a particular relationship or polycule want opposing styles. Some partners only feel comfortable when they share sexual or romantic experiences with their partners, and other partners really prefer to have their dates be separate. This dynamic can be extremely difficult to navigate unless there is some willingness to negotiate or find some kind of compromise that meets the needs of everyone in the dynamic for separateness and shared experiences. If each person's preference for togetherness and separateness is too far apart, it's important to figure out how each of you can compromise, finding a way to get enough of your needs met, knowing that none of you will get exactly what you want. Relationship hierarchy. The topic of hierarchy in CNM relationships can be tricky, confusing, and often quite polarized. Some people adamantly want it, while others determinedly don't. For some, it is unimaginable to do CNM without some aspects of hierarchy, whereas for others, it is offensive to even use the word. As a therapist, I have seen hierarchy used both in ethical and transparent ways in CNM relationships and as a tool to limit and control other people's behaviors. On the other end of the spectrum, I have seen people practice non-hierarchical CNM in ways that honor and respect everyone involved. But I have also seen people cause significant harm in the name of being non-hierarchical. I have had clients tell me in no uncertain terms they abhor the use of terms like primary partner, expressing their ardent belief that relationships shouldn't be characterized in hierarchical structures. And I've also had numerous people timidly admit in the safety of our confidential session that they actually want some form of hierarchy, but are too ashamed to ask for it in the context of their relationships, fearing judgment and backlash from their partners or their CNM communities. When referring to hierarchical CNM in this book, we are talking about the practice of ranking romantic and sexual relationships into a hierarchy of importance, where certain relationships are considered more valuable than others. Typically, words like primary, secondary, and sometimes tertiary are used to describe the various levels of significance, commitment, and influence that each relationship can have in people's lives. In this case, a primary partner would be at the top of this structure and generally afforded certain privileges such as more time, support, or decision-making power, or even rights to set the rules for other relationships. This configuration usually reflects a dynamic in which the people in secondary or tertiary relationships have little to no input about how their relationship unfolds, or are subject to vetoes and rules from their metamours who are at the top of the hierarchy. To further nuance our understanding of hierarchical relationships, in their book More Than Two, Eve Rickert and Franklin Vo point out an important distinction between prescriptive and descriptive hierarchy. Prescriptive hierarchy describes the practice of explicitly naming a particular relationship as primary and prescribes all future relationships subordinate to it. In this context, the primary status usually means that each member of a couple has the right to put certain restrictions or limits on how strong, deep, or intense, or committed their partner's other relationships can become. Descriptive hierarchy, on the other hand, is less about prescribing the container of a specific relationship or the possible connections with other people, and more about recognizing that the circumstances shaping our lives can organically create different levels of priority, commitment, and even power among partners. In descriptive hierarchy, a dyad could function very much like a primary partnership in the sense that they are more domestically, financially, or emotionally intertwined with each other than with other partners. But there is still an openness to allowing the nature of relationships to change or to integrating new people into the relationship constellation. In non-hierarchical CNM, relationships are not arranged within the structure of a hierarchy or ranking of partners. No one person has the right to hold sway over another person's relationships, regardless of whether partners live together or have a longer relationship history. Ideally, everyone gets a voice and has the space for their needs and wants to be considered. Each relationship is given the chance to evolve according to its own dictates. Functionally, many non-hierarchical relationships look like descriptively hierarchical relationships, and you'll see people arguing that the difference is largely a matter of semantics. And despite the fact that in some cases non-hierarchical CNM may include prioritization of certain relationships or different levels of investment and commitment, the non-hierarchical structure does not promote power differentials, advocating instead for flexibility in terms of how decisions are made and how relationships can change over time, according to the lived circumstances of the individuals in those relationships. Terms like nesting, anchor, or inner circle partner have been adopted by some CNM people instead of the label of primary partner, which give more nuance to the nature of these relationships while at the same time acknowledging there are still varying degrees of investment, commitment, or descriptive hierarchy present. Given the differences between hierarchical and non-hierarchical relationships, it's easy to see why these issues can cause challenges for partners who find themselves on opposite ends of the fence. Sometimes these differences can reflect potential incompatibilities between fundamental values, wants, and needs that could threaten the relationship. And this in turn can make talking about this issue very scary for people. What I often see is partners getting stuck in philosophical or intellectual debates about the validity of their respective points of view, or falling into the trap of shaming or pathologizing each other for leaning towards one end of the hierarchy spectrum or the other. Far from changing a partner's mind, this kind of headbutting typically creates more disconnection than mutual understanding. The fear of losing the relationship can also create distortions that greatly limit our capacity to hold space for a partner's perspective, feeding the story that their position on hierarchy is not only inferior to our own, but the principal cause of our potential incompatibility. In such cases, I find it helpful to temporarily put the debate aside and explore the attachment needs underlying these positions, adopting a willingness to talk about this issue in a way that is more relational and collaborative. In PolySecure, one of the things that felt helpful to people was bringing the concept of attachment-based relationships into the context of CNM. Having an awareness of the powerful influence that our emotional attachment system can have on our fundamental sense of safety and security in CNM relationships gave people a useful framework with which they could better understand their relational needs and thus feel more empowered to advocate for those needs. PolySecure also gave more tools for thinking about how to create secure attachments than just relying on hierarchical structures. When talking about attachment-based relationships, we are referring to relationships where you are deliberately cultivating the behaviors that foster and support the development of secure emotional attachment with a partner. This includes things like demonstrating consistent emotional attunement, loving presence, and regular responsiveness to your partner's needs and wants. In these relationships, we feel that more than not, we can count on our partner's support when we feel hurt, scared, overwhelmed, or in need of connection, comfort, reassurance, or celebration. Attachment-based relationships can be forged regardless of your degree of hierarchy or lack thereof. However, they do imply some level of commitment to regularly being available and attentive to each other. One salient distinction to make is between having a secure connection with someone versus being in an attachment-based relationship. Secure connections are with people or partners who may come in and out of our lives with greater degrees of fluidity, but with whom we still feel a great deal of closeness and intimacy. The connection we have with such people can feel very secure, and this connection could be deeply meaningful, special, and important to us, but we wouldn't necessarily invest the same level of time and attention into the relationship as we would with an attachment-based relationship. Having the conceptual framework of secure connections and attachment-based relationships expands our options in terms of how we think about what we need and want from our CNM relationships, particularly with regard to issues of emotional safety and security. Sometimes what happens is that partners are asking for more hierarchy, but really they're just wanting the experience of a more attachment-based relationship. I have seen numerous clients initially use the idea of hierarchy to feel more secure in their CNM relationships, then later realize what they actually wanted was to have a partner put more energy into tending to their emotional attachment needs. On the other end, sometimes partners are saying they want less hierarchy, when what they actually mean is that they want less of an attachment-based relationship and more of a secure connection. Of course, it does not have to be one or the other, where you either want more hierarchy because you want more of an attachment-based relationship, or you want less hierarchy because you want less of an attachment-based relationship. People can still want an attachment-based relationship and also want less structural hierarchy, or more balance between how they experience connection and autonomy in their relationship. Having more clarity about these potential differences between ours and our partner's needs for more or less attachment-based connection can sometimes alleviate the tension around whether or not hierarchy is a relevant consideration in a particular relationship or constellation of relationships. While it doesn't always resolve the issue, it does at least bring more nuance and precision to the conversation and help illuminate what is an issue of genuinely wanting different levels of relationship or wanting a different type of relationship altogether. The point of examining this issue of attachment-based needs is ultimately to help partners tease apart the often confusing tangle of viewpoints that swirl around the question of hierarchy in CNM relationships. My observations are based on the real examples of clients who, after learning about attachment needs and attachment-based relationships, were able to recognize that what they previously thought was an issue of more or less hierarchy was actually a need for more or less focus on their attachment system. By no means am I suggesting that the desire for more hierarchy in your open relationship in and of itself is somehow problematic, or means you are clinging to relational structure for safety or security. It is an absolutely valid want that can sometimes be exactly what people need to do CNM in a way that genuinely supports themselves and their partners. I also do not mean to say that everyone with the conviction to do non-hierarchical CNM is necessarily wanting a relationship with less emotional attachment. As I said before, the absence of hierarchy in no way precludes attachment-based relationships, and non-hierarchical styles of CNM can offer people important ways of relating that allow them to be in alignment with many of their core relational principles and values. However, with all that said, it is important to recognize that some people do use hierarchy to control their relationships and avoid feelings of insecurity or uncertainty, while others do use the concept of non-hierarchy as a way to avoid commitment or being considerate of their partner's needs. If you fall into either of these two categories, it's important to recognize this and be as honest as you can with yourself about it. If you're using the concept of more or less hierarchy as a substitute for something like attending to your attachment-based needs and wants, or being honest about the level of involvement you really want in a particular relationship, you will most likely find yourself in relationship dynamics that continue to leave you feeling unfulfilled and dissatisfied, and your partners and metamors confused and hurt. However, if you are clear on what level of hierarchical structure and attachment-based experiences you want for yourself and with your partners, you will be much better equipped to negotiate these differences or to come to terms with the incompatibility they create in your relationships. Sometimes the differing degree of hierarchy or lack thereof that partners want is incompatible, and one partner always feels their freedom is limited while the other can never get enough safety and security. When partners fall squarely on opposite ends of the hierarchy spectrum like this, I rarely see things work out. The gulf between the respective wants and needs is too great, and no amount of negotiation will bridge it. However, when people are a bit closer on the spectrum and the possibility of inching towards your partner's position can be done in a way that doesn't leave you overly compromising yourself or your own needs, then there is a chance to find a middle ground. While this may mean that you have to sometimes manage circumstances that are not always ideal or easy for you, your love for each other and your desire to be together ultimately make it worth it. Similarly, the fact that your preferences for attachment-based connections are different from a partner's doesn't necessarily mean the end of the relationship. If partners agree to wanting an attachment-based relationship, then it's important to explore the differing needs around freedom, exploration, emotional attunement, safety, and connection in order to recognize and adjust expectations accordingly. Therefore, when talking to partners about how you want hierarchy to show up or not in your relationship, get clear on exactly what you are agreeing to and asking for. Here are some helpful questions to guide your process. Based on your history and experiences, when has hierarchy been helpful for you or your partners? When has it been challenging or harmful for you or your partners? Based on your history and experiences, when has non-hierarchy or less hierarchy been helpful for you or your partners? When has it been challenging, hurtful, or harmful to you or your partners? What aspects of hierarchical structure do you want in your relationships? What aspects of hierarchical structure do you not want? What attachment-based experiences would support you in feeling more secure in your relationships? Why are hierarchy, non-hierarchy, an attachment-based relationship or a secure connection important to you? Some best practices would be, if you want hierarchy, articulate why you want it and how it connects to your values and understanding of yourself and what you need. Don't use hierarchy to control your partner or their partners. Don't use hierarchy to avoid your own feelings of jealousy or the uncertainty that inevitably comes with being in any relationship, regardless of structure, but particularly in CNM. If you do have aspects of prescriptive or descriptive hierarchy, get clear on why this is most aligned for you and do your best to communicate this to partners. Differences that make less of a difference. In this last section, I want to shift gears a bit and talk about the cases where differences with partners actually become less of an issue when we are non-monogamous. Sometimes within CNM, we can become more accepting of the differences between us and our partners, because the criteria for what we want in a relationship changes, allowing more space for those differences. Many people know that it's not possible to get all of our needs met by one person, but the prevailing monogamous narrative still suggests that it's reasonable to expect one partner to meet the majority of our emotional, intellectual, sexual, and practical needs. This weighty expectation puts us in a particular situation where our criteria for potential partners has to include an exhaustive list of everything we could possibly want in a relationship, because if our chosen partner doesn't check one of our boxes, we're basically doomed to live without it for the rest of our lives. A beautiful benefit of CNM is that it can release the tension to get all your needs met by the same person. The result is frequently that they experience even more acceptance and appreciation for who their partners are and the gifts they bring to their life, because now they can focus less on what they're not getting. Furthermore, in CNM, the new relationships that we explore can have much more flexibility in terms of the criteria and standards we have. For example, in a non-nesting relationship, the differences and incompatibilities that could be problematic in exclusive or nesting relationships are often inconsequential. This frees us up to have connections we wouldn't otherwise entertain. Without the expectation that we will be intertwining our lives in the same way we would with a nesting partner, we can allow more differences to be present, and this in turn gives us a chance to experience genuinely novel things with these new partners. In these kinds of relationships, the differences between ourselves and new partners can actually represent refreshing contrasts that expand our sense of who we are. Chapter conclusion. As partners explore non-monogamy together, they are simultaneously presented with the gift as well as the potential threat of contrast. When new to CNM, sometimes these differences are exactly what we needed to bring more awareness to our relationship dynamic and make the necessary changes to keep growing as individuals and as partners. In other cases, they spell the end of the relationship that was already riddled with issues and simply waiting for the right detonator to finally end things. Either way, the transition from a monogamous to a non-monogamous paradigm can be a tremendous catalyst for either growth or disillusion, depending on the nature and degree of the differences that arise as a result, as well as how partners choose to deal with them. Similarly, for those of you already steeped in CNM, the process of taking on new partners, changing how you prioritize certain partners, or making significant changes to your CNM style or level of hierarchy can create stark differences between how you and your partners want to experience sex and romance, which can bring a lot of unexpected things to the surface. Attributes that were originally endearing can become intolerable. Questionable characteristics can turn into deal breakers. And even the language we use to make agreements can be rendered inscrutable. Also, as we begin to intimately engage with new and interesting people who are different from us, we can be inspired to live our lives in new ways. We can discover new relational possibilities and freedoms and experience levels of compatibility and attunement that we didn't even know were possible. This new perspective forces us to see things we may not have seen before and often makes many of the things we weren't paying much attention to come to the forefront of our awareness. For better and sometimes for worse, the new vantage point that we gain through the differences that emerge in our new relationships forever changes the way we see ourselves and our relationships, and what we ultimately want from them.